This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on February 10th, 2017. Today's guest, a reoccurring guest, a frequent guest on this infrequent podcast, is Jeremy D. Miller, the Shade Tree developer, prolific open source author. And today we were going to talk to Jeremy about some of the open source projects that he has had around for years and some new ones too. So hello, Jeremy.
Hey guys, that's good to hear from you. It's been a while.
It has been. I think we recorded a short show with you at one of the NDCs somewhere a couple years ago.
Yep.
But you still got all sorts of things cooking. You've got open source projects now that cover containers and databases and testing frameworks. I don't even know where we should start here.
Well, let's talk about Martin. Let's dive into Postgres.
Yeah, I have found that to be fascinating. So tell us about it.
All right. So my shop for several years and a job or two before this as well, we've gotten to where we really like using document databases. It's much less friction in development, fewer database changes. There's just a lot less mechanical work to get your business functionality done and out the door. So that's great. We were having trouble in production with the document database that we did have. So when we started reading about all the crazy cool new features for JSON support in the PostgreSQL database, we kind of said, hey, let's give it a shot. Let's see if we can put a client library right on top of Postgres that makes it act like a full-fledged document database. So get the workflow that we want at development time. It's great for automated testing, but be running in production on something that's a much more solid foundation and make sure things like backup tools and replication and monitoring and all that kind of stuff actually works.
And so you produced a library that is quite full of features, right? You have full link support and all sorts of things going on.
Well, I can't claim that it's full link support. You can find gaps in the coverage, but quite a bit of link coverage, ability to use JavaScript to do on-the-fly transformations, all kinds of goodness for reading and writing. We've had a really good response from the community, and a lot of ideas contributed, and quite a few outside pull requests coming in to extend it and push it along.
And you had a blog post late last year, I think it was, about choosing this technology over an object relational mapper, where you made some pretty good points. What specific things still stand out to you that you're happy about with this technology versus like entity framework?
Oh, think of cases where you add a property to a document type. One of your domain model classes. With an ORM, you might need to stop and make a database migration to add a column, go touch your ORM mappings. Just a little bit of the wormhole anti-pattern business coming up. With a document database, it's much, much simpler and much less work to keep the database schema in sync with the object model, because it's just the object model serialized in this case. So the ability to use a more emergent or evolutionary software design practices, or just to be able to have a system that can accept change as you go through a longer life cycle.
And you're talking about storing domain objects as documents in there. I'm guessing you do that. I know you've also had some posts about using this as an event store.
Yes, that's actually, I think we've had more uptake in the event store than even just for a document database. So it's not some of the core functionality and infrastructure's actually pretty similar. Still using the Postgres JSONB format to store events, and the hard part of the event store, having an event sourcing architecture of any kind, is, you know, that's great. We've got all these raw events, but how do I get to derive what is the real system state? Because I don't have something necessarily. So we've had a lot of success building up view projections in the event store. So as the events come up, you can be updating the full read side view of what is the current state of my application, or be building up views for specific pages or specific needs. And the advantage to having that all inside of Postgres and Martin, the read side projections, they're just documents. So they work just like any other, your own kind of documents in Martin. But the great thing is you don't have to have additional infrastructure. Everything is one database, only one place to monitor, one thing to replicate and back up.
Gotcha. And you have, I think, really good documentation on this that I'm just browsing through, where, once again, your APIs are always so well designed. You can just say document store.4, pass in a connection string.
Well, thank you. I will say, on the documentation side, from I had so many years of abuse and criticism for the structure map documentation being badly out of date or just plain wrong, that I make that a much bigger emphasis these days than I might have in the past.
Yeah, just trying to give people a feel for this. I can see where you do a document store.open session, then you want to do a session.query. You can pass in a generic type parameter, say, I want my users, and then add a where clause. I'm just curious, behind the scenes, a little bit of the implementation there. Is that all the documents going to a single table in the database, or are you?
No.
Okay.
You definitely not want to do that. No, each document type has its own underlying table. They're not quite the same. They'll all have a couple, some metadata columns, you know, what last modified. The main state is a single JSONB column. If you're not familiar with Postgres, that's a type specific to Postgres. It's a binary representation of a JSON document. So it's much more efficient for searching, querying. And then along the way, you also have the ability to set specific indexes within the JSON document. In a few cases, it's actually valuable to say, I want to duplicate this one field. And what that means is pluck this field out of the raw JSON and stick it in its own column as well, just to make it easier for me to write SQL or do foreign key type relationships.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, you're saying JSONB is more efficient. Like, I've looked at some others, like, I guess it's pronounced BSON or whatever. I mean, some of them are, like, comparing, some of them are more compact. Others are not necessarily more compact, but are just more highly indexed and stuff. Like, is that something, I don't know, like, number one, how does that work? Or I guess a side question is, does it even matter? Like, do you just know that it's working and it's all abstracted away?
Well, as a user, you don't have to know. We are told just by the Postgres metrics that they put out, searching within the JSONB document is faster than the plain Jane textual JSON. Just because it's already parsed out. As far as how more or less efficient it is storage-wise, I honestly don't know.
And then, so, like, naive question, there's the ability, because I can just store JSON documents in Postgres, so, you know, like, what are the main things that you're adding on, like, what... Somebody just looking at this going, like, why don't I just throw a bunch of documents as JSON into Postgres, like, what is the, you know, big things on in Martin, just a lot simpler kind of API on top of it?
Oh, sure. Actually, quite a bit. So we've already talked about the link provider and The link provider, I'll definitely say the link provider is going to be much more user-friendly than getting down to low-level Postgres, SQL, JSON manipulation. Beyond that, we have a unit of work implementation. So your document session you were talking about, that also represents a unit of work, same way that a DB context would for EF. So it gives you transactional semantics. It enables you to do the event capture in the same transactions documents. We have had to invest a lot in database migrations, tooling to keep your underlying schema up to date and have it reflect what your document structure is. So not just, oh, I got a new document type, make it. That part's pretty easy, but things like, I've added a new duplicated field, or I've created a new foreign key relationship between document types. And Martin's actually able to spot the difference between what you're declaring and what is actually in the database and export out the Delta file that you can use for a database migration. Beyond that, we have a lot of support. So strong typed expression type support. So you can express database indices based on properties of your document model. So Postgres supports calculated indexes, and we'll take care of that for you behind the scenes, all nicely, strongly typed. And Postgres also allows you to run JavaScript directly in the database. So there's a lot of powerful things we've been able to do, partial document databases, but also using a very plain JavaScript function to transform the raw JSON might end up being a very powerful alternative to tools like AutoMapper. Just instead of pulling a lot of data down from the database, twisting and turning it into what your real domain model is from the ORM, and then immediately turning around and transforming it to the DTOs you want to send out over the wire and serializing. With Martin, if you're building a web app, you could conceivably just use JavaScript to put the raw data in exactly the format you want and stream the JSON string directly to your HP output without ever incurring all of that extra overhead of serialization, deserialization, and that dance.
Okay. You mentioned Entity Framework there, so I'll just ask that question as well. Like there is some level of Entity Framework support for Postgres. Did you work with that at all, or did you have any thoughts on layering on top of Entity Framework, or is it just totally different?
John, I actually had a very brief conversation with a member of the EF team very early on. We originally had the idea that we would try to eventually make it an add-on for Entity Framework, just from the perspective that probably make people much more likely to try to use it. Honestly, getting farther into it, it's just such a different data structure. I'm not sure that it would have been a good idea to try to do that.
Yeah. And it definitely, wouldn't try and push any, it does sound pretty different. I'm just curious to ask for people that'd be familiar with that.
Sure. And one thing I should say is, if you adopt Martin in Postgres, there's nothing stopping you from using, on the same application, using Postgres as a straight up relational database, using Entity Framework from some parts of it, or a lot of our users in my shop like to use Dapper for lightweight things. But it maybe get a little crazier than some people want to do, but you could do that within one application and one database engine.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the document databases out there offer transactions, but a lot of them have said you just have to deal with eventual consistency. I was wondering where Martin falls in all of this.
So the document database we had been using wasn't completely transactional, partially. So when I give Martin talks internally, what I like to just say, Martin is acid all the way down. You are able to query the real state of the documents as soon as a transaction is committed. And usually like to pause and wait for the applause that almost inevitably comes when you say that. Now, there's some pretty big advantages of us building on top of Postgres. We're not having any issues with the eventual consistency. There is a little bit of eventual consistency you can opt into on the event store for certain kinds of aggregations. You may decide to do what we call it asynchronously off to the side, so you're not slowing down the event capture itself.
And just curious then, what's the testing story? So I built an application with Martin, and then I wanted to write some unit tests. I wanted to write some integration tests. Any special stories there?
Well, so let's take integration tests first. With integration tests, automated testing, it's a very important thing to myself and my shop. So that's been built in pretty hard from the beginning. We have a pretty easy mechanism to, in one fell swoop, to just say, delete all the data. Delete all the data that's currently in the database. If you wanted to go even farther, you could tear down the whole schema, but that's overkill. From there, what we do is establish a very slim baseline of lookup data, maybe or maybe not. And from there, try to run with basically a clean database schema per test. So that's in the integration testing world. And I should say a document database, I think, especially as your data gets hierarchical, it's a lot easier to deal with an integration testing than a relational database. I'm not fighting all the time with, I need to create a bunch of fake data over here just to make it stop whining about foreign keys and having to be much more thoughtful about how do I delete things in the right order. A document database, just delete this document and it's gone. From a unit testing perspective, this is a place where I'd like to get a little bit better. The advice I'm trying to give our teams is to do very little mocking of the Martin document session itself. There are some use cases, just saying, I want to store this document or I want to load this document by ID. That's fine. We have a concept called compiled queries that encapsulate a link statement so it can be reused. I'm saying it's okay to try to mock that in a unit test, but otherwise, the second you get into asynchronous programming and returning tasks and all kinds of places where you have to interact with Martin a lot, I'm saying go integration testing all the way.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So one of the things that Postgres JSON data supports is like in-place change operations, like, add a child or add an element to an array in place or, add a sub-property in place and sort of patch the object without, reading it out and then putting back a new version. Is that something that you can do directly through Martin?
Yes. For right now, we don't use the built-in JSON operators. Martin uses just a little bit of JavaScript, a JavaScript stored procedure to do the patching. So we can, like you were saying, we can add elements to a child array or list somewhere in the document. We can insert it first. We can change properties, remove properties if you've changed a document structure and you want to do that, and three or four other things that escape me right now. But yes, we have a patching API for just the reason you said.
Something else that I saw in the documentation was your mention of Squitch. I don't know if that's how you say it or not, but that sounds like an interesting tool.
So the guys I work with call it Sketch. I hope that's how you say it. I had never heard of it until our team doing the big Martin migration, got into it, but it's a very simple mechanism for creating database migrations with just straight up SQL. So there's no real custom language, but in the case of Martin being able to dump the DDL deltas, it makes it pretty easy for Martin to feed directly into what Sketch already wants to do.
Hmm. And then I can just apply database changes to get you to the latest version, I guess. Apply the DDL statement.
Yeah. Look at the database. See, there's a metadata table for it. What's the last version applied? And apply everything after that.
Gotcha. I guess database migrations would be something that you do when you add a new document type. Would that be an example?
When you add a new document type, that's the big one. But a little less often, maybe when you decide you need an extra index on a document type, or there are a few other changes you could make to a document type, but I don't think that's going to come up too often. Mostly it's going to be, I need to add a new document type.
Gotcha.
Question about that. So, one of the things that I had to deal with a lot from back when I was doing MongoDB work was, although you didn't have schema migrations, you had an equivalent, which was sort of, data migrations. That is, you wanted to make structural changes to the set of documents to normalize all the set of properties in them, or to add or remove properties across all existing documents. Is there any sort of mechanisms for doing that kind of stuff?
So I've been suggesting to use our patching API for that. So the patching API, allows you to do one document at a time, or all documents of a certain type, or all documents of a certain type with a given where predicate. And failing that, if it's something that Patch API can't do, we have a mechanism where you can use a JavaScript function, something that takes in JSON and spits out a different JSON object, and use that to do data migrations. Now, as far as moving, like splitting documents up and moving, renaming document types, maybe come back and ask me again in 6 months.
One of the things on the release notes for the 1.3 release was lowering memory usage. And I saw a few things as far as, like on the changelog. One was like buffer pooling, and another was using string builder and stuff. Was there any like one thing that was like a huge advantage in memory usage?
I did the string builder work, and that didn't make a huge difference. The big work, a contributor did a lot of work to eliminate some of the usage of JSON strings. So instead of constantly serializing objects to JSON strings that have to be allocated, deallocated, he put in a design using an object pool of character text writers, so that it was kind of being able to reuse already allocated memory and write directly to kind of almost stream the serialization without having to go through that extra step of creating the JSON string. And it may not sound like much, but benchmarks came up the before and after. It was a third of the memory allocation if you were doing a lot of inserts or using our bulk insert mechanism. So it was a big deal.
Wow. Yeah. It's interesting that, the stuff like I've learned about from the, from what they did on Kestrel optimization was just like huge, huge performance changes, reducing allocations and trying to avoid like just treating input strings as integers and longs and stuff versus like allocating string. It's crazy how big a difference that kind of stuff can make.
Definitely that. But you might summarize that as, in any mechanism you use in code to make it really clean and concise, probably does a lot of harm in terms of allocations and performance.
Yeah, so Martin's out there. It's at version 1.3. It's in active use. You have an active Gitter channel, so it sounds like you have another successful baby on your hands.
Absolutely. Scott, I think I've claimed that, and I still will, I think Martin is the most positive experience I've had doing OSS so far. We've got a pretty busy Gitter room. I think we're somewhere in the low 40s of how many folks have contributed. It's been really positive. But yeah, from the main document website, there's a link to the Gitter room, and there's generally people on there full time. We've got contributors in Hong Kong and plenty in Europe and the US. So one way or another, we got you covered on time zones.
So one of the really compelling things about Martin is that, I don't know, the JSON manipulation APIs in raw Postgres are a little bit, I don't know, funky, not that fun to deal with. And this is versus something like a MongoDB, which has this very nice sort of JSON-y kind of API. Do you know if are there other libraries on other platforms that are kind of tackling this problem that you're aware of? Because it does seem like kind of a general purpose kind of an issue that, you know, providing a nicer API on these funky JSON APIs.
Oh, absolutely. It would be nice if there was something. It would be really nice if there was something more standardized. So I'm kind of with you. I don't necessarily like the Postgres syntax, and I don't think I would want to use it raw all the time. But if you take a look, so SQL Server and Oracle are both quite a bit behind Postgres as far as what kinds of things they can support with JSON. But I think both the SQL Server and Oracle syntax for doing that same kind of querying and manipulation where it exists is actually easier to use than Postgres.
Hmm.
So I believe SQL Server gives you kind of a dot notation. So it looks like accessing deep within the document, it looks like the JavaScript code that you would write by hand to do the same thing.
I wonder if there's any hope of some sort of standardization eventually around this stuff.
It would make Martin would be much more successful in the .NET world if we get it moved to SQL Server as well. How about that?
Scott Coons on the show.
Jaded developer here. I have a question.
Sure.
Actually, that leads to what you were talking about there, migrating it to SQL Server, leads into my next question is, what is the selling point of Martin? Is it the API or is it the Postgres integration or is it both?
Yes. Postgres has a lot to offer and there are a lot of capabilities that just aren't necessarily all that common. I would say Martin adds a lot of value on top of Postgres, but I say that because I'm a big believer in the document database approach. And I feel like we're able to have the best of both worlds. We can have the flexibility of a document database, but yet still have transactions and ACID rules and backups and replication and all that kind of good stuff.
So the follow-up to that was porting it to cloud-type DB. So Bigtable, the Azure Document DB, which has its own issues right now that I don't think would suit it for this kind of work, but something like that. If you've considered anything like that, or if you're just like, hey, can I just get this thing working right first, and then I'll worry about supporting the rest of the world?
Yeah, pretty well exactly that. I had to get things done. I was doing this. Most of the work I did on Martin was during work hours for a specific need. So it had to get done. It's very tightly coupled to Postgres right now. And
it would take a while to change that. But my hope is Postgres just gets more popular and you can host Postgres on anything. So there shouldn't be anything from stopping you from using a Martinized database in the cloud. And most of our users use hosted Postgres anyway.
Every time you say Martinized, I think of a clothes cleaning shop that was open in my hometown when I was growing up called 1 Hour Martinizing.
Totally thought
okay,
of that too.
Okay, wasn't just me. So my second or follow up question, I guess, is more around performance of querying and like, do you have any best practices maybe around querying across really complex documents, or do you have is it just like we just don't put a lot of data in it because it's linear the time it'll take you to query versus how much you got?
No, so you got a couple. We've got a couple options. We invested a lot of time in performance optimizations. So the easiest, cheapest thing to do is you can set up calculated indices. You can say in your bootstrapping for this document type, I want to index on this property and do it with a Lambda expression so it's all strongly typed. That can even go deep inside of the object structure. There could be a couple dots there. That's one option. Another option is, and I have to recommend this occasionally, if you have like a deeper document that has children and the children have children and you want to do all kinds of weird searching on the leaves down like that, one thing you can do is put a calculated field directly on a getter only document property that kind of establishes this is what I want to query against, if it's if it's an array, and that when it serializes to Martin, when Martin serializes that, you can then index that calculated field and short circuit the querying time. And then the last thing, and this is strictly on Martin mechanics, we have a feature we call compiled queries that it's in your C# code, but you essentially create a little query object and it has a hook to say, this is what my link query is. So it turns out to be a huge advantage. It enables us to bypass having to parse those link expressions out every time. And you can go pretty well straight to, this is the SQL you need. This is how it's going to be handled and read, and that makes a huge difference in performance. Beyond that, we're experimenting the underlying library, the NPGSQL client library that enables you to use Postgres from .NET code. They've added some new functionality for preparing SQL statements. We're going to play with that soon. We still need to do that same kind of buffer pooling on reads, but that's actually already underway. And then another big thing you can do with Martin, both reading and writing, it's very easy to batch up statements to Postgres with that NPGSQL library. So Martin has a pretty robust batch querying mechanism where you can say pretty well any kind of query that you can possibly do in Martin, I want this, and you're really getting a series of task T's out, and then you can send the whole thing up to the database in one round trip. So applications where you might be having performance trouble because you're just being way too chatty between the application server and the database server, the batch querying may give you a good mechanism to cut that off. Oh, and just to throw this in because somebody would ask about it, we need to go a little farther with it, but we do have the ability when you're querying to what we say include related documents. So if I'm trying to load a user document and it references, the assigned user or the reporting user, you have a mechanism to go and grab that related document for me at the same time in one round trip.
And that would happen on the Postgres side or in memory?
Behind the scenes, you would invoke this through Martin API, but behind the scenes, Martin's just doing a join.
Yeah, okay. Yep. a couple months ago or a couple weeks ago, I can't remember which, you started talking about a new project you started called Alba. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure, sure. So there's a big niche that we don't have filled very well at my office. We have a lot of unit tests, you know, down talking about a web application. Unit tests that go down to, I'm going to test just my controllers or controller actions in one place. And then we also have big, massive end-to-end tests using Selenium, Laborious, Slow, nobody's favorite. In between, in the middle there, a lot of our web frameworks, they're trying to use things like middleware, filters, what we called behaviors back in FUBU, MVC. And there's a lot of things going on in your HTTP request around your code. So the Alba project is more or less recovering and adapting some testing techniques we used in FUBU MVC to enable you to run the full stack of code that would handle an HTTP request, but do it without needing a web server, so that you could test directly against HTTP endpoints and see, you know, what does happen when my controller runs with this filter in front and this thing behind and caching and all this good stuff. So,
yeah, so it's like the in-memory HTTP client behind the scenes somewhere?
Definitely that. So there's a feel dirty. There's a tiny bit of reflection to get at it, but so this was originally built and designed around Owen, where it was really easy to just say, I have whatever that old Owen, was it app delegate? Do you guys even remember?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Sounds right.
App
yeah.
Funk.
I seem to recall something.
Yeah. App
about
Funk.
It, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope that wasn't bringing up bad memories. So the ASP.NET Core world, it really moved a lot closer to what Owen was trying to do and also what some of the OSS products, like my old FUBU MVC project, were trying to do. So in ASP.NET Core, you have that request delegate. I pass in an HTTP context and you asynchronously do something with the request. So Alba tries to bypass the web server. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but Alba gives you a declarative mechanism for saying, this is what my request is. So helpers like, well, I'm really posting this input model as JSON. So you would say post as JSON, push in the model, and Alba will take care of, well, I know how you want to set the request up. I'll serialize it to JSON for you. I'll write it to the HTTP request body and maybe also set some headers up to be able to send this on. Beyond that, Alba, it was originally inspired a little bit by the Play framework in Scala. They have really cool functionality for writing very declarative tests against their HTTP endpoints. So we've tried to follow a lot of that. So as you're setting up what we call a scenario, you know, saying I'm issuing a GET to this URL or I'm posting this JSON object and I expect these things to be true coming back. The header should be this, the status code should be that. And at the end of it, I get a little bit of a helper around the HTTP response that came out of this that I can then go a little bit farther and we have utilities to help you. Well, let me quickly deserialize the JSON output into the whatever the strong model was that originally generated, or let me read all the text and help you be much more able to do explicit assertions on the HTTP response at the end of it.
So when's the kind of cutover? You mentioned in your announcement post about this, that you looked at the test host that comes with ASP.NET Core. When's kind of the cutover for when it's like time to, you know, move from that kind of lightweight thing to, you know, using Alba?
Honestly, I think it's probably going to be preference. I think and hope, and I'll first admit that I didn't realize the test host existed when I started porting Alba over from Fubu. I think Alba's going to do a lot of the legwork for you that you have to do for setting up these kinds of tests. You know, dealing with the stream data, the serialization. There's even, I don't have this working for ASP.NET MVC core yet, but we will. Being able to do some reverse URL lookup. So you can start to express your tests of, well, if I do a post to this controller action and let Alba deal with what's the route pattern supposed to be that matches this to send it all up. So okay. I think maybe the just short way is I think Alba is going to end up being test host plus plus.
I am curious. So, I mean, I think these types of tests are a lot easier to write than anything that would get the Selenium server involved. Would you use them, these types of tests, to replace any integration test, or are they really for that fine line where you're trying to test middleware and stuff that's just in the pipeline?
Well, both. My time is justified in Alba so that we can do many more. We can effectively do many more testing scenarios without having to fire up Selenium. So I would say any point where you have any kind of significant HTTP service where you'd really like to just test the full HTTP endpoint stack and measure the output there. So I would get it to the point where I would only want Selenium for a handful of end-to-end tests or something where the UI is really tightly intertwined with the back end, but mostly would try to avoid that scenario when you can.
So in just noticing here that like Alba is ASP.NET Core, you know, looking at what you got from Martin, that's .NET Core. So you've been developing all kind of recent stuff in .NET Core. I just wondered what your experience was with the, you know, the porting and the, you know, I don't know, version changes and stuff.
Well, I've had some of the same consternation that a lot of people have had. Martin was fine. Martin was not that big a deal. Alba was developed on core from the get-go. That was no problem. Supporting the core CLR with StructureMap and my Storyteller project, that was a nightmare. The changes to reflection, system.reflection, and I know that stuff's supposed to be coming back with Net Standard 2, but that threw me for a really bad loop. Places where I didn't have a lot of reflection or a lot of crazy reflection, core CLR usage was pretty slick. Now, I'm pretty conservative about these kinds of things, so I'm staying back on project.json for the time being. But I would definitely say I love the Project JSON format. I'm sorry to see it go. I thought it even made NuGet dependency tracking, NuGet publishing so much easier. And then I would say the .NET CLI is just a huge slam dunk. And I would recommend pretty well any .NET team if you aren't using that's actually worth the cost of upgrading your technology stack, in my opinion.
Just the .NET CLI? Just for automation or tooling or what?
It makes the project automation almost trivial. I've been able to tie in some other projects, have been able to tie into the CLI extensibility. That turns out to be really nice. But just things for like, I say, you know what, I want to run this test suite with only .NET Core or only with .NET 4.6. The .NET CLI is a really fast way to get that kind of thing done, and it makes project automation almost trivial.
I wanted to go back to an earlier comment you made that Martin was, I think you said it was the most positive experience you've had in open source. I think those were your words, but was that because of a change in your approach or a change in the environment? What do you think made that better?
Well, I'm going to admit that I think I came in with low expectations. but let me follow up and say, I think the .NET world and .NET ecosystem is definitely much more helpful and positive about open source work. I think the Martin idea, I want to take Postgres, I want a document database, we can build it on Postgres. A lot of people had the same idea at the same time. We were just the ones that came out. So it turned out to be pretty easy to find a niche and people who were interested in contributing and helping develop it pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But even outside of Martin, what I could say, StructureMap is the biggest thing I have as far as user support. And you will hear me complain on Twitter about, more questions come in and why do you want to do that? But I see a trend now over that I didn't see 5 years ago. When users report bugs, they work with you a lot more to solve the problems. So instead of just screaming at you, this is broke, they kind of take the attitude of, we are collaborating to fix a problem in StructureMap or Martin or whatever it is. That's very helpful. I'm seeing people give bug reports, something the Martin community does that I love. Thank you, guys. I'll pretty frequently get a pull request that has a failing unit test, failing integration test, that demonstrates exactly what the problem is they're seeing. And that's huge for being able to fix problems. And I think the cap of all of it, I actually get pull requests for Martin and occasionally for StructureMap for documentation updates. Mm-hmm. And that's something that would have been unheard of in .NET world 5 years ago.
So since you mentioned StructureMap, you had tweeted at one point fairly recently that you were getting kind of burned out on StructureMap and maybe looking for someone to take the project over. So what's the backstory there?
Oh, it's just... it's been 14 years. I want to feel like I'm done with it. And people still find creative, unusual ways to use it, combinations of things that I don't necessarily think are a good idea myself, but they still get in these situations. And it takes a lot of time to work with folks to understand, what are you really trying to do? Could you really design, could you architect your app a little bit differently so you didn't need to do that? And it's just kind of worn me down over the years. So there's that. There is the ASP.NET Core has a built-in container. So there's maybe 30 or 40 open source IOC containers in .NET for some reason. I would bet that all but a handful are going to be dead in a couple years because it's kind of a commodity and it's built into the framework now. Why bother? And then the last thing, I'm just a little bit tired of it and getting a little bored of it. And the ASP.NET Core IOC integration, it just has an absurd number of assumptions and little rules and a lot of things that aren't the way that StructureMap works. A lot of times it's things that I never wanted StructureMap to do because I always thought that was a bad idea. But to have 100% compliance with how ASP.NET Core says an IOC container should work, that's being a lot of ongoing work, and I think this is a good place to look for the exit ramp.
I think after 14 years, you've earned that.
Have you had any takers on that?
Yes, I have. There's a couple people that are helping with questions here and there. Matt Honeycutt is picking up quite a bit of the maintenance, fixing bugs, asking questions. I'm not completely stepping away, but the folks have stepped up. So StructureMap is still viable. It's still going to continue. It's just going to be better for everybody involved if more or different people than me are doing more of that work.
So we had a question from Frank on Twitter, and he asked, why so much hate for Scrum?
Well, some of it is maybe I'm just an old curmudgeonly guy, and I came out of, or I was exposed very early on to extreme programming when it was all about developers and what's the, how can we make our environments such that we can continuously write code and get things out the door without feeling all the frustrations that we had in the waterfall world, right? And that was a great heady time. And then Scrum just wiped out everything else. Scrum, the certified Scrum masters, the project managers, the management, I feel like they completely seized agile development and turned it into something very different. From my perspective, I don't like that Scrum puts so much emphasis on ceremony and tracking and almost completely left behind so much of the thinking and practices from extreme programming, the very code-centric approaches and practices we use to make iterative development actually safe to do. So the cutesy phrase I think I've taken to using, and I think you guys are about the same age I am. Do you remember how much you hated Scrappy-Doo and how Scrappy ruins Saturday mornings?
Yes.
Scrum is the Scrappy-Doo of agile software development.
Actually, I was thinking he's the Oliver from the Brady Bunch also. He's there. No one knows why he's there. No one really wants him around. He's just annoying, and he's eventually going to kill your project.
So, Jeremy, you had a recent post that really cracked me up, and it was about the iTake pull requests and the different kind of meanings of what does that actually mean. How would you do? What are the different kind of things that it can mean to people?
Well, from the most positive to the most negative, I mean, it could mean, hey, you know what? I think this would be a great pull request for you to do. This is an approachable thing that you could a newcomer could come in and quickly do. And that would be great. I always like seeing my contributor numbers go up. Makes you feel good. Sometimes it really means I think that's a good idea and I would like to see it, but I don't have the time to do that myself right now. But I'll take your pull request. And, you know, there's a few times where, especially with structure map, somebody has asked me for a feature or capability that I would never use. I'm not even sure that I feel that great about having it in there, but you know what? If it's important to you, sure, I'll take a pull request. And then, you know, finally, I think the stereotype that people hear when they get that, you know what, I take pull requests. Frankly, when I get somebody that's being really difficult or being very demanding, and this doesn't happen anywhere near as often as it used to, is you shut the conversation down with, I take pull requests. And it's really code for go f yourself.
Right. You know, honestly, that's I kind of default to when I hear that. It's kind of like, yeah, go away. But I think it is kind of nice to see it as like, okay, fine. I mean, recently I contributed something as a pull request and it was Windows support for a Node library. I'm sure they would have never cared about it, but then they're like, yeah, you know, and they ended up accepting it after some discussion, you know, and it was kind of, I don't know.
No, and that stuff's great. A lot of this conversation, it's happening electronically, it's happening online, you don't have the facial cues, are they, you know, it's so easy to be offended online because you don't know if they're trying to jab at you or what they're thinking, but I mean, more and more, I say that I take the pull requests and people actually go do it instead of continuing to yell at me.
Jeremy, you also did a post recently on agile database development, and there's a paragraph where you're talking about how agile and relational databases work together, and you're using words like challenges, laborious, expensive, irreversible, crash and burn. What are the highlights of the post? How do you think about agile development that involves databases?
Well, to some degree, relational databases have been, for a long time, have been like the final frontier of agile software development. If I'm trying to be agile, I want to work iteratively, I want to constantly be changing and modifying existing code and being able to test things, having, you know, really safe testing automation so I can move with confidence. And relational databases don't really like to be changed in that way. I know some of your listeners are absolutely going to know what I mean. The portal stones in the Wheel of Time series, the stones that mysteriously resist being moved, that's a database. And plus, I think one of the biggest problems, and I'm about to get in trouble for this, the database community, I don't think they embrace a lot of the agile movement. I think they kind of tend to be pretty conservative. I think some of them stop learning after they read EF COD papers in college. But I'm not sure that they're always as aware or they put as high a priority on the ability to change and deploy quickly and to test. So the tooling is a little bit lacking. For test automation, it's just kind of a pain in the neck. It's more mechanical work, more code, more typing to set up scenarios, the input you need for scenarios, than it would be if I were building objects up in C# or in almost any other environment, in my opinion.
Yeah, so jeremydmiller.com, that's where the blog posts, that's where all your blog posts live, that's where people can go to get more information on these posts that we're talking about. And I think with that, it's probably just time to ask if you have anything exciting coming up here in the future.
Honestly, no. My wife and I are expecting in May, so you will not see me anywhere in public for quite a while.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
A new release coming.
There you go.
Thanks, Jeremy, for being one again.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. It was good to catch up with y'all.
And thanks to everyone who is listening. See you next time on Herding Code.